Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kate.
Hi.
And Swara.
Hello.
This week, we are talking about Western adaptations and remakes and kind of how they interact with the thing that they are trying to reproduce and reimagine. A lot of this is based off of a recent trailer that dropped. You probably know the one, but we'll get to that. But before we get to that, what have you guys been enjoying lately, Kate?
Ooh, okay. So this is wild. So I try to do my good TV critic thing, and I try to watch the scripted TV shows that have gotten the most play on different platforms. Mm-hmm. Lioness.
That's
is
a lot
like,
of 10-hour commitments.
It is. But so Lioness is essentially a series on Paramount. It's pretty like it is. It is the most, I'm going to say biggest, it is the biggest piece of military propaganda that I have seen in years. And that's how I'm starting this. Like, literally.
You watched Top Gun. There was a Top Gun movie, Kate.
It's bigger than Top Gun.
Good God.
Like, it's crazy. So, and the reason I say this is because one of the main characters, she is running away from a literal abusive boyfriend. And falls into the only place open to save her, a recruitment office for the Marines.
No.
Yes. So what's wild about this is I hate military propaganda. Yep. Also, the leads are Latinas, like very specifically. She is escaping gang life, very specifically. For me, I hate propping up things that continue to prey on my community because like it is what happens consistently to black and brown people, especially with arms of the military like the Marine, where they just use them as cannon fodder. And yet I'm still watching. Like, it's like I keep pressing play.
Ooh, okay.
And it is, and that's the reason like I bring it up, because it is one of those situations where it is actually good TV, and it's giving my brain like this weird thing where it's like, I hate everything that this thing is standing for and the way that it is approaching certain topics. However, like, there is a subplot about queerness. There is a moment where one of Zoe Saldana, who's the other lead, where her kid gets into a fight, and her kid tells her dad, who the kid's dad, Zoe Saldana's husband, who is white, I don't want to hear, you know, a white person telling me about this. He's like, I'm your father, and you can't beat hate out of somebody. And then the kid goes, but I can try. And I'm like, yo, that is a moment where you're supposed to care about and be on the kid's side. Zoe Saldana, like, literally stomps a attempted rapist's nether regions multiple times and is like, this is what we do to people in the military when we knew that they would keep doing it. Like, it is insane the unhinged levels at which this thing, definitely geared like dadcore TV, goes in on actual problems. And then wraps it back around to military propaganda and some pretty bad stereotypes. But I can't name another TV show right now that has a Latina lead, let alone an Afro-Latina lead, let alone two Latina leads that are pulling the entire thing together. So I'm in this weird space where I don't want to tell everybody to go watch Lioness, but I do want to say, I get it, y'all. Like, I see why everybody is watching it. And I am confuddled. I'm confused as to why I'm engrossed in this story.
That feels like it has some shared DNA with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which was, you know, copaganda, but was like
also had two Latina
really
leads.
Good characters. Yeah, two Latina leads, which if I remember right, there was an interview. I can't remember if it was with Stephanie Beatrice or Melissa Romero, but talking about how when they heard that the other one got it, they were like, oh, so I'm not going to get cast. And then they were like, oh, no, we want both of you. And it's like the fact that that was a huge deal like less than 10 years ago is.
Well, and I will even say, though, you can say two Latina leads, but they were two Latinas in an ensemble because Andy Samberg was the lead of the show.
Oh, yeah.
Zoe Saldana
is the lead of this show. Yeah.
And the other woman is the other lead, the two stories that you follow.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I do agree with the overall piece. Having two in one project.
Yeah.
Apparently rare in 2024, despite the Latino population being over 20 million people in this here United States.
And then also having it be like, this is compelling but problematic, which is kind of how I felt about Brooklyn Nine-Nine toward the end, where I was like, I'm having a great time watching this. I know it's propaganda. I know this is supposed to be making me feel a certain way about law enforcement.
Like, the show is consistently about, like, it is weird because it's consistently, like, we're talking about the Lionesses, which is an all-female group where they embed them, like, where the women in, like, they're, it's all the women soldiers embed themselves in, like, terrorist cells, but, like, talking to girlfriends and wives. And okay. It is insane. And, like, there are moments where I'm like, yo, this is kind of racist to, like, everybody that's displayed here in the show, I will say. And then it, like, wraps itself around, and it's, like, oh, actually kind of compelling. Not, like, the Tom Clancy let's break down the war machine type way, but in the, like, huh, you actually thought about this thing that you were doing. Anyway, I'll stop talking now, but I'm literally in the middle. I'm on episode 7 of season 1. That's what I've been doing.
I feel like this is actually the perfect time to bring back the phrase viewer discretion advised, where it's like, do watch this, but be discerning about it.
Yeah. Like, be aware of what it is and how it can be used as propaganda, how you can have many compelling stories, such as most famously Top Gun, which was critically acclaimed. Top Gun, what was the name of the film again? Top Gun.
Maverick.
Maverick, yeah. Maverick. Like, it was one of the most acclaimed film of the last few years, and still, like, oh, we can still point this is military propaganda. It's like, these truths can coexist, and it's important when we talk about art and how it can be used for those propagandistic purposes, but you can also separate that out. And yeah, like, it's, I remember this episode, Alex, you and I spoke with Adrian about quote-unquote problematic faves, and, you know, it's like, yeah, but anyway.
I wouldn't even call this a problematic fave. Like, it is just somehow this most conservative dad watching TV show that has an entire subplot about a lesbian romance with two women succeeding in the military, and is somehow, like, it is if you took Demi Moore's G.I. Jane and made it progressive, but also situated into the quote unquote war on terror.
Right.
Like, a subplot is the other Latina lead scores the best on her ASVAB and the best in the men's PT. Like, using stripper strength, I might add you, which, like, they don't explicitly say, but, like, homegirl was a stripper and, like, did more pull-ups than anybody ever did. And I'm like, oh, that's because of the pole work. Anyway, now I'm really done. I'm sorry if you're listening to this. The Lion, like, this has been consistent talk in this house, because I'm just, every time something new happens, I'm texting Matt, because I'm just like, I don't know why my brain is, like, locked in here. But it is.
Yeah. No, I get that. Okay, so moving on, Swara, what have you been enjoying?
This does not need me to add on to the chorus, but I'm going to anyway. I'm just obsessed with the Penguin. This is one of the best on-screen. Like, remember I made a list for But Why, though, a couple years ago about the top, my top 10 live-action, based on a comic, TV shows. This would immediately be in the top 3, at least. It is magnificent. This, like, you know, single season series, the entire cast, Colin Farrell, obviously, but Kristen Milioti as Sofia Falcone, i.e., if you watch the show, Gigante, give her an Emmy already. She is fantastic. And I just love the Batman universe. I'm even more excited for what the Batman 2 is going to be. And I'm just, like, so heartened that this show did so well. It started off, like, relatively moderately, but then it built its audience with each episode. It just got more and more anticipatory, and the thrills of it. Also, speaking of diversity, this is a super diverse show. You know, you have Shora Agdashloo, Iranian-American icon, as main woman of the Moroni family. And you have Renzi Feliz, an amazing new role as Victor, who works with Oz Cobb. And it's just like, I don't know. It's just like the quality of the storytelling throughout it. I haven't been that big a fan of crime shows, but this is sort of my foray into that. And that just, like, now I get why people are so hooked on this. But I'm also grateful and hopeful that it will remain a single season, because this is, like, one show I haven't said this in a while, where I just want it to be a single season, because I think it wrapped it up so fantastically and with a launching pad for the next film. And I loved it so much.
Because limited series are a thing, and you can just have a limited series. A mini
You can just have
series.
10 really good episodes.
It's not a single season show, Suara. It is a limited series.
Right. Limited series, yeah. Yes.
Well, and I wasn't saying that to be mean, but like,
No.
Because all of us, like, we've become a culture of like, well, give me two. Yep. So it's refreshing to hear you say the Penguin is just like, this is the story. This is a tight story.
Right. Like, you get to the finale and you're like, ooh, that was good. And I'm content to walk away. And it's also, honestly, it's kind of hard to pull that off with the show to like, get to season, to the last episode and have people say, like, excellent. I'm finished. Like, I've got what I
need. I am satisfied. And there's something I was talking about with my friend Neebs on his show, Salam Nerds, is that when we were talking about contrasting this with the MCU TV shows or Disney Star Wars shows, for that matter, where you have, like, effectively fragmented movies in 6, 8, 10 parts. But with the Penguin, you have a coherent episode every episode. So you're
left, and that's huge.
Yes. You're left feeling satisfied at the end of each. And the conclusion you get and how it brings it all together is just bellissima, amazing, French kiss, all the accolades.
I'm into that.
Oh, I will say, I'm not going to talk about it forever, but I do want to say, if you've not watched Cross on Prime Video, watch Cross. Aldous Hodge has been a star since Leverage, but now he gets to be a true leading man. And it is a adaptation of the Alex Cross series. Which is really cool, and he's really good. Serial killer, Hannibal vibes, Silence of the Land vibes, like, it's good. It's good.
Into it, yeah. Love that. For me, it's a little bit scattershot, so I've been listening to Me Without You, who I don't know that either of you guys know who that is. It's a post-hardcore art rock band.
I know exactly.
I'm obsessed with them.
Is.
One of my favorite bands of all time. They just put out a live album called Live, which is confusing enough. And what they did was they stitched together songs from a bunch of different shows over the last 5 years, because they just did their final tour. And then when they released it, the tracks are song one, song two, song three. And the idea was, they were like, when you listen to this, it should unfold like a live show. And that's like, that's the whole thing. The mix on it is fantastic. Cool. The performances are really, really good. They pull from all over their discography. Like, it's not really, it's kind of weighted toward one album, but it really does pull from everything, which for a band that went from like post-hardcore screamo to like Sufjan Stevens-esque, like, you know, acoustic guitars and harmonies, to pull from both of those for the same show is kind of difficult. But they pulled it off. And so, yeah, that's a great one. There's two more compilation live albums coming. Also, the Linda Linda's new album, No Obligation, was really good. I finally listened to that one. And I also, in terms of catching up, the IDW reboot of Ninja Turtles, even though it's not really a reboot because it's continuing. Yeah. I'm 3 issues in. Issue 4 just came out today as of recording this. Genuinely very impressed with what they're doing with it in terms of letting the old series continue to exist, letting the ending be canon, you know, whether or not people liked it, but writing the progression of the story in a way where it's like, we're not going to dwell on what happened in the aftermath of that, because that's not interesting. We're going to jump ahead to, you know, getting the band back together and all that. So the first four issues, each one is focusing on a different turtle and what brings them back to the way things were. So yeah, I've been really enjoying that. And then last very quick one, I finally picked up Bomb Rush Cyberfunk, which, if you guys like Jet Set Radio Future, it's basically that. It's just a different company that made it. But I loved Jet Set Radio Future when I was a kid, had it on Xbox. And being able to play a game that plays just like that, but is modern, has been pretty cool.
No, that's really cool. I feel like we do need to give a shout out to Kendrick Lamar committing yet another murder. A murder so bad that Drake is suing his own record label for inflating Spotify views.
I just, like, what is Drake thinking? I don't understand. I truly don't.
It's just, yeah. I love it. Lose your shit some more, man. Like, do it. Yeah. I mean,
it's just...
We're about to celebrate this at the Super Bowl. So, like, everybody's about to be yelling out A minor in the middle of the biggest, the most watched sports game in the United States. I had to clarify that with the United States.
Yeah. But yeah. Yes. While he is, suing, opening himself up to discovery, which I'm like, dude, do you want to do that right now?
Those Ozempic receipts are going to hit different when it's coming in an official case file.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's gonna be rough, thank you guys for sharing all that. I'm definitely gonna check those out, and The Lioness with some discretion. Where can people find you online and find your writing's on butwhytho.net, but where can people find you?
You can find me over on Blue Sky more and more. I am still on Twitter because I'm not going to lose the community that I made there, but I'm posting more and more on Blue Sky at Oh My Myth Randier on both. You can follow us at But Why The Winner on Blue Sky. We actually don't have to add the PC to it that time. But all my writing is pretty much right there now. And then, I'm doing a Final Fantasy 14 monthly housing column over on MMORPG.com. I got to use the phrase dollar store wainscoting and make jokes about Chip and Joanne's Magnolia Network. That's what you can expect.
Excellent. And Swara?
Y'all can find me on Blue Sky, which I am surprisingly really enjoying the last several weeks. I'm there at Spider Swars. I unfortunately had to close down my Twitter for personal reasons, RIP. But I don't know. I actually feel better. I just enjoy Blue Sky more as an experience. Maybe because it's an echo chamber, maybe. But like, I enjoy it. Y'all can find my writing on butwhytho.net. Oh my god, butwhytho.net. In case y'all couldn't tell, I was recently sick and getting back into the gist of things. And along with other websites, Nerds of Color, The New Arab. I recently on The New Arab actually had a piece go up about the DC Palestinian Film Festival, so I hope you all will check that out. And also check out my podcast, The Middle Geeks, where we discuss anything and everything in Swana Media.
Nice. And you can find me actually, I'm still on Twitter because I don't want to give up the username. And then you can also find me on Blue Sky at Most Always Alex. Just reach out, see what I'm up to. I'm going to try to use Blue Sky more than I was using Twitter because I kind of fell off and just stopped tweeting things because I did not care about that platform. It's brighter days ahead, fingers crossed, for social media at least. But with all that said, let's move on to the main segment. Western adaptations, Western remakes, and the Western part is specifically because we're also going to be talking about like foreign language films being adapted. And this was all kind of inspired by How to Train Your Dragon, an animated film where a big part of that film doesn't exist in the real world. So doing it live action still requires animation. But Swara, you want to talk about your feelings on that? Because I know that you were the one who was like, hey, guys, this sucks. And I want to talk.
I watched the teaser trailer and as well as the behind the scenes for the How to Train Your Dragon live action. I was like, I'm morbidly curious. Gonna see my reaction, and I was pissed off. I just saw this CGI Toothless looking almost identical to the original animated version.
It had HD textures, is what it is.
Right, and I was just looking at it.
It was Unreal 5 Toothless.
It really was.
Yes, and I was just so pissed off, and looking at the like. Carbon copy, how this was a carbon copy remake, scene for scene, at least in what they're presenting. Maybe it'll be different. But still, like that marketing in and of itself pissed me off because I'm like, what is the point of this? Except a craven capitalistic. Oh, yeah. It all goes back to capitalism, you know, obviously, as we're going to get in this conversation, but still, it bears repeating the sheer lack of originality. If this was like 20 years down the line, I wouldn't have been as pissed because How to Train Your Dragon is very recent. It only came out in like the 2010s. And
yeah, there's not enough of a technology jump to be like, we can do things we couldn't do then. It's like,
right.
No, it's still mostly the same. I also, real quick, going back to your point about like the look how one-to-one this is, that reminds me of when The Last of Us was out and somebody posted a video of like, here's the game cutscene and here's the movie. And like all the replies were like, then watch the cutscenes on YouTube. Like all you've shown is that this didn't need to happen.
But you see, with The Last of Us, I would argue that it deviated significantly.
They did expand and, like, eventually. Yeah. But like just at that point, episode. It's like, then don't praise it.
Right.
Yeah.
Just, it's one episode. It doesn't count. I'm sorry. That thing, like, yeah. Neil Druckmann did that show because he wanted to stroke his own ego and he doesn't believe that games is a viable media for. Like, no, like, based That's on fair. His comments, he's explicitly said that everything was made to be for Hollywood.
So, oh, I didn't see that, actually. Sorry.
Yeah, all I'd say is whenever someone's like, we did a remake, look at this, it's one-to-one, we framed everything the same, yeah. I'm just like, okay, but why right. did you do that?
And like, that's like one of the reasons that I was excited kind of to talk about this, because I would say by and large, especially, and we're talking about Western remakes specifically, because I would argue in mm-hmm. Japan, it's a very different story. They remake and adapt manga and anime all the time and animation all the time. And it's just a part of their pipeline.
Yeah, now, they budget for wigs.
Exactly. Most of the time they budget for wigs.
That's okay. Fair.
That being said, though, I think that there is a way to do adaptation correctly. But I also think when we look at like the How to Train Your Dragon piece, like I think the one-to-one of it all is bad. I also think in general, like, how do I say it? The difficult thing I want to put in this argument for us to talk about is what differentiates the animated movies adapting a book and a live action movie adapting an animation. For me, that question is answered by the fact that those were still movies. A movie is still a movie, whether it's animated mm-hmm. or not. But I yeah. do kind of want us to think about that as we go through, because like I do think it is important that we're talking about a specific type of adaptation, because a lot of mm-hmm. the properties that were like, oh, why are you making it this? Well, they were something else first. A lot of the times books yeah. or comics. So I do kind of want to like have that lens. But Toothless looks horrible. Like, you murdered my boy. They murdered my boy.
No, it really is just a weird choice. And I mean, like you said, Suara, like, it's not even that old. Because I think there is something to, it's like, oh yeah, you remember this movie that came out like 50 years ago and all of the effects are really hokey and they were clearly reaching for something that wasn't there yet. I'm like, yeah, cool, remake that. That doesn't bother me. But when it's like, I mean, to go back to video games and to go back specifically to The Last of Us, when you remake a game 2 years after it came out and then another like 5 years later or whatever, it's like, what the hell are we doing here? Like the yeah. technology has not evolved enough. Because I do think, I think the progression of filmmaking and effects can be a reason to adapt or remake something. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of this, I mean, honestly, I would say even some of the Disney remakes, and I don't want to get too bogged down in those, but I feel mm-hmm. like the Disney live action remakes are a part of this because they just were like,
frankly, Alex,
hey, let's, I mean,
frankly, I would say they're a huge part of it. I think that this is DreamWorks is trying to chase the success of the Disney live actions that have done really well at the box office for all of our and many others complaints about them. They still make buck. So other studios are going to yep. follow that pathway.
Definitely. Yeah. So I guess let's talk about the scope of this, because I feel like what the big things that I wanted to hit on after talking to you guys about this was animated film being adapted, foreign language films being adapted. I know that there is like a little bit of stuff. I mean, like we just got Wicked being adapted, where a 3-hour musical got turned into 2 3-hour movies that are coming out
that
a year apart
from
each
other. Book first. Like they
that were all a book
first.
That were based...
That
were like
based
a
on
sequel.
Another property.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Wicked pipeline is insane, of like book to film to book to musical to film. I think animated and foreign language films are kind of the big thing here. And like obviously we have How to Train Your Dragon, we have Disney's. I think my big issue with Disney's remakes is they're like, we're doing live action Lion King. And I was like, oh, so real lions? And they were like, no, animated lions that
Unreal
look real.
Unreal 5 Mufasa.
And I'm just, again, it's like, what the hell are we doing here? Like, this isn't a live action film. It's just a differently animated film.
I mean, I couldn't bring myself to watch the Lion King, quote unquote, live action. Yep. I read reviews of it and I'm like, I'm good. And I'm just like, I know I'm being a bad film critic by not actually seeing the movie, but also if I don't have to review it, if I've seen enough of these live actions to know yeah. the formula, I don't know. again, I still should give it a chance, but there are critics I trust out there who would say, like, yeah my definitely. Fellow critics, like, including it. But why the writing community that y'all should check out on the website.
Definitely.
But, yeah.
And then...
Sorry, you go ahead, Alex.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and then, yeah, there's the whole industry of foreign language remakes, and I feel like this is... like, the most recent one is Parasite is getting a TV show adaptation that is not the movie... Yep. Right, but it's like heavily inspired by it.
Essentially, what are the America's what cashing are the other in ones? On Korea's success, essentially. So
yes,
the explosion of like the Hallyu wave, the K wave, that's hip hop culture. We saw it once with Old Boy when that broke out, and Spike Lee, I think, was forgiven too quickly for the sin that was that American adaptation of Old Boy. But Squid Game's getting adapted, Train to Busan is getting adapted. On the other side of things, Americans are also adapting Your Name, which is an anime feature film. And I think that, like, ultimately what this is like those are identifying things that have come out in other places and not trusting anybody to actually want to see somebody else's culture and just make the money for themselves in English. And I think that, like, the reason that it was important, and I kind of brought this up as why we should talk about it, like, in this talk, is because ultimately, like, I think a live act, making an animated film a live action and calling it a one-to-one. So, like, it's not that, like, this new live-action film is adapting the books in a different way that the animated film adapted the books. It is like, no, we're remaking the animated film, is a disrespect towards animation as a medium in filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think in the same vein, remaking foreign language films, international films, as English-speaking American films is also a disrespect to that country's cinematic history, and it's disrespectful in both ways. I think things can be done that isn't disrespectful, but I think for me, as we go through this conversation, it is going to be about how important and inaccessible is this piece of media to a new audience. That for me is kind of the crux of where you think it will go.
Yeah, totally. It's about how they're repackaging this for to make it more quote-unquote palatable for American audiences if it's a foreign language film, and thus limit their perspective, their already limited perspective. We should be watching more international films. We should be watching more international series. Part of the reason why, you know, Parasite or Squid Game, you know, these were really lauded as great successes because it really did expose more Americans to that culture and to that sort of storytelling. Unfortunately, like, a lot of, many would argue, like, the wrong lesson was taken, such as, like, Netflix saying, oh, we're gonna make our own Squid Game, and just like, what are we doing here? Like, did you miss the point of like, what it was trying to convey about the capitalist Korean system? I definitely think Americans, like, we just we like, this is like, on frankly, it can be on it can be on the audience too, of not seeking out enough international films, enough international media, and we need to be making more of that effort. I think, thankfully, you know, such as On But Why Though and other sites, like more indie sites, are trying to broaden that perspective, but you still have this Hollywood system that is so invested in the Americana of it all.
I would push back on that. Like, I think one of the things that makes But Why Though unique is the amount of dedication that we put towards international programming for TV and film all year round. I think a lot of other sites, unless you are geared yourself as like a Korean site or like a Korean culture focused site or a Japanese culture focused site, a lot of the time sites that are looking to hit an American audience to discuss these things only do it during award season. Like, that is the bigger issue. The reason we're getting a Parasite is because Parasite was an Oscar winner at the end of the day. There's been studies that show that if a film wins an Oscar and it's international, that is when somebody starts to watch it in the United States. Having people interview Lee Jung Jae, who, like, has a historic career out of Korea, asking him, how does it feel to make it big? It's like, no. Just because he's giving
you
an he's been big. And I think that, like, there are larger mechanisms at play where, like, I actually don't think that there's an infrastructure from a critic's perspective, because when I get my critic surveys, there are no foreign films in animation. And that's something that happens every year. there are hardly any foreign films in any of the other categories. They just get lopped into foreign film and that is it. They don't get to compete for any other thing, which I think is that larger issue. So I actually like, I think if it is mm-hmm. normalized to seek things outside your culture, like right. anime, where like people get mad at you if you watch it in English, then you end up with a system that is wanting to watch more stuff. I don't think that that is there yet. And I don't think there are a lot of sites doing that work, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I would say even this year, I don't think we did it that well because we had a lot more constraints when it came to our staff. So I think that like that is always going to be a mountain to climb. And mm-hmm. there is a level of recognition that has to kind of go into it. But I do agree that like it is on the consumer ultimately to be like, just give me this in English, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think too, with the whole, even the idea of the American market and the international market, the mm-hmm. like going to the interview as an example of like, oh, you're in a real movie now. And it's like, no, dude, he's been in real movies. Like mm-hmm. he's in an American movie and you are saying that your worldview, those are real movies. Or like mm-hmm. people who see foreign film as being like stuck up and snobbish and like for smart people and aloof. And it's like, because you have to read, you see reading as being aloof. Like I don't, you know, and I mean, you don't even have to read to watch a movie that is not from the US. You can watch movies made in Ireland or whatever, and like it will still be in English for you.
Those still, the Irish films do still need subtitles though.
Some of them, yeah. But it's like, at that point, it's like you just have to adjust yeah. to like slightly different cinematography and different storytelling tropes. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get over yourself enough to do that, you're going to be stuck just watching American movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's a really, it, like it is, I feel like as much as it's on the industry for doing it, it's also, like you guys have been saying, it's on the consumers, I yeah. think in a bigger way than consumers are aware of.
Because I would say too, like half of the issue, like as we start moving through the rest of the notes, like with the animated animations getting live action, that is because our country and our Hollywood in general has devalued animation to just mean for kids. And so yep. there are films like IFC Films released Memoir of a Snail, which is an extremely adult animated film that I think is from Australia that I think is going to sweep. But the thing is that film would never work out of its animated style. But there is mm-hmm. an assumption that in order to be real film, to reach critics, to reach people, you must be live action. And I think that that becomes a larger issue. And I do think, not to center this around The Last of Us, but I also do think that that is an issue with a story like that, or a creator that sees it and doesn't safeguard their intellectual property in storytelling, but also pushes it out, because like the guy who made Squid Game is also making bank off of that American game show that they did, is mm-hmm. also making bank off of the American version that's coming through. And so I think that like there is an issue between artists safeguarding, if allowed to, if they own the rights, because that's a whole nother issue, but and the mm-hmm. audience is key there as well. But I also think yeah. we have to take in these larger cultural perspectives that we just refuse to shift.
And I do want to talk about animated films specifically. You talked about mm-hmm. like that, the movie that doesn't work outside of its style. And I feel like that's kind of been my big thing with animated adaptations, is like animation is just significantly more flexible. You can convince me that there is a giant robot in a junkyard way easier animated than you can live action. Like I buy Iron Giant, I don't buy Transformers, like yeah. visually.
So I'm gonna go into something a bit personal without getting into too much detail. My parents very much do not like that I love animation. They think it's quote unquote for kids. They come from a generation, or at least part of their society, where if you're watching cartoons, you're watching something only for kids and you're not being a true adult. There's this emphasis on, oh, we want to watch something live. Actually, I'll just say this. I once tried showing my mom The Good Place, thinking that she would enjoy it, but she said like, no, this is like too young for me. This is has too much pop songs in it, or something like that. And
they do have Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
All that to say is there is still this pervasive notion that mm-hmm. you cannot in any way be a mature adult yeah. and just enjoy animation and enjoy things that are designated for kids which not all animation is, some significant animation is, like Disney animation is, but that's treated relatively seriously, even though Disney animation has been going down the drain in the last several years. And it's like, it's sort of like this, they sort of want to have their cake and eat it too, of, mm-hmm. oh, we're going to like, you know, focus on this as an art form, but only to a limited degree, and say that, yeah. oh, it's primarily for children. If it's going to be really quote unquote high art, it has to have a live action adaptation. So I would, as I understand it, in Japan with anime, you know, it's vastly understood for decades that anime is a medium with various different audiences, adult, children, teenage, etc. And yeah, just here in America specifically, because I'm not actually quite as sure as Western Europe, although I would imagine some of it is the same. Mm-hmm. I actually think it might be more flexible. I don't know. But there's still that pervasive notion of like, this is for kids, immature, and we need to make it high art in order for it to be truly serious. Never mind that Beauty and the Beast like was nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture because they actually appreciated it as an art form at the time. And then years later, we got the cruddy live action with Emma Watson's auto-tune.
Yeah.
You know?
We're not going to crack necessarily the why doesn't culture respect animation thing, but I just need to posit this because as it occurs to me. So like, if you go to the Louvre, you see a lot of art, right? You see a lot of drawings and paintings and yada, yada, yada. So how come that is for adults, but as soon as you put three of those together, like a flip book, it's for kids?
Yeah.
Like, if a painting is art, why does it lose that status as soon as it moves?
Yeah.
People are stupid is what I'm getting to.
Yes, no.
And that's a very blunt way to put it. But no, like, what the hell?
People are extremely stupid. And I think like, I think to Sora's point, because I do want to kind of like add in a little bit of credit here. Like the Japanese culture doesn't just view animation as being able to hit different audiences because they revere it. It hits those because they have set demographics within what they do. And that goes all the way down to the base medium of manga and graphic novels, which we would call just graphic novels or comics. Like ultimately the way that they view it is there are things made for teens and there are things made for adults. And when you mm-hmm. adapt things made for adults like Berserk into an anime, that anime becomes an anime for adults or just an animation for adults because anime is just Japanese animation. And I mm-hmm. think that like that is where the issue does lie with the U.S. is we never had that same target audience thing because mm-hmm. and I do like I hate how much we go back to Disney on this podcast a lot, but I do blame Walt Disney for that. I blame Walt Disney for it in the cap and like the way that that became like the giant money maker. And once you had somebody set a standard for animation, that standard becomes OneNote. It's the same reason Futurama, mm-hmm. American Dad, and Family Guy all have similar styles when it comes to art and comedy. I would argue Futurama is the best of them. And The Simpsons, right? Like all of those yeah. styles of adult animation look the same. It even goes into Rick mm-hmm. and Morty. And I think that like when you look at that, you can see where the medium has been stunted. And I know that Guillermo del Toro talks about this a lot, where he specifically says animation is a medium. It is not a genre. And we view it as a genre here. And until we look at it as a medium, mm-hmm. which is something that can be respected, we're going to consistently fall into this piece where the most flexible medium there is to tell a story, we don't utilize it, regardless yeah. of yeah. things.
Back to the point about like the American Dad, Simpsons, like that adult animation, it mm-hmm. almost seems to be in the same mold of like it's a crude, funny yes. adult joke, like mm-hmm. just sort of one note like that. Why can't we have a high drama animated film? Why can't we have a mm-hmm. A musical that's not a typical, again, Disney or like a mm-hmm. kid animated mm-hmm. film, but rather something that is yeah. higher art. Like something I love to do is watch animatics on YouTube. People who, back when I enjoyed Hamilton, I would watch a lot mm-hmm. of those of like, you know, and it was effectively animation set to this relatively mature content of this musical mm-hmm. or in Wicked or in other musicals. Mm-hmm. Like we should be adept, like... You know, one of my favorite films of all time, 2019 masterpiece Cats, it should have been adapted in animation. It should have been an animated film. And even though it's somewhat for kids, but still, is Cats is a musical. When you look at it, it can be for all audiences.
I do want to ask, do either of you know when the last adult animated musical film was released?
Was it South Park?
No.
Team America World Police.
So did you all not watch it? Because both of you just named the Crude Humor one. It was Intergalactic on Netflix. It was Kid Cudi's animated.
Oh, I don't think I've heard of that one, but I'll check it out because it is everything that we're talking about.
But that's the other problem.
I need to watch it still.
I'm not doing that to like shit on anybody. Like I think that there is an issue that like when these things get made, they don't get watched. I think Netflix has actually been pushing everything forward when it comes to adult animation. You have something like Intergalactic, but you also have something like Arcane, the Castlevania series, the Tomb Raider series, Sesmanos, like actually everything that Powerhouse Studio is doing. I would argue to a different point, even on the Star Wars side of things, I think Visions has actually embraced the first season. The second season was definitely very kiddie, but the first season as a Vision was very embraced that more, and it was all Japanese, with that more seinen style of storytelling, hitting that older audience with some all ages pieces involved. But I think that that is to say that like there's a second part to this where I think we also as audience members and as critics also have our blind spots when it comes to this, because it is harder to find, because it is not marketed. Had either of you heard of Memoir of a Snail at all?
No.
Have you all watched Flea?
No.
Dutch animation documentary film
about an adult refugee. I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it.
Yeah, like, and
oh, yeah,
I've
heard of it, yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that is also tough having this discussion, is because I feel like a core of it is, like, stop remaking our animated movies. Animation is art. But then when we're having this conversation, one of us has watched these movies. And I think that that's larger, a more indicative problem. Because I do think, and this isn't giving the studios and money hungry execs anything, but there, I do think at the core, adaptations serve to inform a new demographic or a new generation of the story that came before it, right? Books, when people grew out of the books, nobody bought the books. Everybody watched the How to Train Your Dragon movies. It's same thing with The Wild Robot that just came out, which is probably one of my favorite animated films of the year. And I think that it's important to put that into perspective, because I want to make sure that, like, we also have to make sure we're doing our part to actually, like, stand 10 toes that animation is a medium and show up for these pieces. Because while I will say watching, you know, all ages animation, like, yes, everybody can love it. But why are more people not seeking out the adult animation that's coming out there? And I think that that is giving the studios the fodder that they need to make these really horrible adaptations. Because a lot of these things just don't translate well. And it looks bad.
Yeah.
Yes. No, you're exactly right, Kay. I need to, like, take on more of that responsibility for myself as a critic, as a lot of us do. And I guess it's... And I'm guilty of this, y'all know this, of sort of getting swept up in the discourse about something or like whatever it is that the mass media and studios are selling out to us. That's something to be aware of, because they do rely on the oxygen we give them as like critics, as writers, as like people meant to promote their piece effectively. I mean, like, not that we're promoters, we're writers, we're critics, but like in terms of like writing,
we are critics, but the way that a company will use our words is for promotion. Yeah. We've all, most of us have been pulled in quotes and everything. So,
yeah.
So yeah, if they don't have anything to pull, then they're not going to invest further.
Exactly.
But what about, how do you guys feel like, foreign language films fit here in terms of, like, we've talked about like the strengths of animation where it doesn't translate and why it's weird or difficult to, but I think for me, the big thing that jumps out is just like, these are stories that are, I mean, they're like written in a different language, which can bring its own challenges in terms of like how things are said, structured, mm-hmm. like how jokes function. Like if there's a reason that games have localization departments who are like,
exactly.
how do we make this work? Mm-hmm. But then aside from just the language part of it, there's also a cultural component. Like these are different world contexts. Like a movie about Marines made in Iraq is going to have a different bent than a movie about Marines made in the United States.
Yeah.
Just the worldview, the context, like all of that stuff, like it all shifts. And I think that's where I personally get very skeptical of
yes.
adapting anything made outside of the US into a US film.
Yeah. And that's
especially with the cultural context.
Yeah. Sorry, and that, I think that's ultimately the goal, right? Like, I think that there is an assumption, and I think that this comes from a wider, I don't want to say like xenophobic place, but I think it's a very, I believe that execs, one, see something make big money. They want big American money. They want money too. Like that's the bare bones of it. But I also do think that there is a wider assumption that people are stupid and they see Parasite do a big success in the United States. And they think, well, if we made this into a show, it will actually be better because it'll be in English. And more people will watch it because they don't accept that there is a path for an American to identify with the struggles of somebody in Korea, to identify with the classism in Korea. And I think it is like there is a lot of American exceptionalism that goes into adapting these films that does nothing but belittle that entire, like I said earlier, like the cinematic history of those countries that it's doing from. Mm-hmm. I also think, while I'm sure all of us here have seen Parasite, right? Assuming all of us have seen Old Boy, Train to Busan, you know, those big heavy hitters.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, but how many of y'all have seen The Departed?
Okay. Which is based
actually, that
Chinese
was one that
film.
I skipped.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But have you watched Internal Affairs?
I've not yet.
Yeah.
I need to. Yeah.
And I think that that's one of those larger issues. And I think now, I think a lot of American filmmakers have done sly adaptations. I think The Departed and Scorsese is a good example of
this. I was going to say, there's something weird about an adaptation done in a way that people don't realize it is, where it's like,
because it's
I
not
mean,
marketed
cause like,
that
even
way.
Like, even The Ring, I think people were aware was an adaptation.
Yeah.
You
but
know?
If it's not
and
it, marketed
but then there's
that
like these,
way.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, here's a new Martin Scorsese film, and people were like, oh, cool. And then we're just going to leave out everything behind it.
Well,
and
I mean,
that's,
you saw
yeah.
that happen in like the J-drama adaptation stage, State of Horror. It started with knowing something was a horror movie, so like Grudge, The Ring. I didn't know Dark Water was a Japanese film first. I didn't know that Pulse was a Japanese film first. I didn't know that I knew One Missed Call, but I didn't know that The Eye was a Japanese film first. Like, we have done this historically because it is just IP mining. What is happening now is I think that there is a more connected ecosystem between general audience, critic, and studio, that they are being more forthright with what they're putting out there. And I think that that's probably a key to understanding that, like, they are still doing this and now they're doing it without the guys, because I do think they think our audiences are stupid, ultimately. And I don't believe audiences are stupid, because I do believe a good story told is a good story told, regardless of the language and regardless of the country that it comes from. And it's interesting to see what people want out of foreign language movies, because they want to strip the context. I think, like, even Train to Busan, where does that work in the United States? Where?
Yeah, like, what train?
Where? What cross-country train are you gonna take that's gonna take place over an entire day? And the speed at which the train is moving is essential to the story that happens within a contained period of time.
Also, where that many people are taking the train, if we're being honest about American, you know, public transit and infrastructure.
They're going to go into, like, the weird little Amtrak over here, and two people are going to be on that thing going to San Antonio. Like,
I think I just figured out the worst possible way that they do this, and it's that it takes place on the subway in New York City, which is a dumb way to do it. And that's what they're going to do, is, like, what's the most American location we can pick that has a train that everybody knows? Especially because, like, I watched the original Train to Busan and I was like, no notes. Like, this was a good movie. It was a contained story. I didn't feel like there were things that I was missing or that I couldn't piece together on my own. Like, I mean, no more than, you know, like if I'm watching a movie from the 80s and somebody pulls up in a car and I'm like, I don't know if that's a nice car. I'm not sure what this is supposed to tell me about them. like outside of like little things like that, that I can just suck it up and get past. I don't think I had any issue like understanding that film as someone who was at the time not very familiar with Korean culture at all. Like, you can hang, you just have to believe in yourself a little bit.
Which I do think goes back to Suara's comment about his parents not liking that he likes animation, right? I do think that there's a certain element that you mentioned earlier where people think, oh, well, you only watch foreign films. Ho, ho, ho. It's like, dude, the foreign film I watched was Project Wolf Hunting, and it was like The Predator and Michael Myers had a baby, and it took place on a ship, and somebody got their spine punched out of them. I promise you, this is not art house.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and I think that that is the issue, too.
Yeah. There's also that everything's high art or whatever.
Well, that's the thing, is there's this weird paradox, like double think of American movies are like good movies and good art, and this is real. And then foreign movies, though, are also all very artsy and intelligent. And I'm like, so are we making the real movies, but also the stupid movies? Like, is that what you're arguing?
I mean,
because, yeah, you know, like every country has schlock movies and horror and like just bad movies that are like not funny.
But if you want some great horror, obviously from Sweden, Let the Right One In, mm-hmm. which I think got a U.S. adaptation that wasn't as well received.
Yep.
Yeah. This one film from Iran, which is about vampires. A girl walks home alone at night.
Great movie.
Great film. Yep. And yeah, there's so much out there, including in animation. I mean, outside of Japan, which is the pinnacle in my opinion, but you have like Pakistan now coming out with their original animated film, The Glass Worker, which looks beautiful. It looks very Studio Ghibli, but I'm not mad about that. It's like, if you're going to be inspired by any animation studio, why not Studio Ghibli? Plus, they're both Asian. I sort of want to go to a broader point, actually, if y'all will permit me. I'm just like thinking of, in doing self-reflection, how we Americans are inundated with so much of the same. Of so much of the same characters, franchises, you know,
Pixar
obviously
moms.
Pixar moms.
Well, I was actually going to say just Pixar, like kind of getting increasingly one note in their animation, and Disney as well, like visually. Yeah. But Round. Pixar moms is just the funniest way to phrase it.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, like I mentioned, I started like off this this podcast talking about The Penguin. And it certainly is a standout amongst, you know, DC series or comic book series. But still, this is DC. We've known the Penguin for decades.
Yep.
And
but this time they matured him up by making his last name not Cobblepot, right? Because that's too silly for a man who calls himself the Penguin.
They've matured it up in many other ways, believe me. But yeah, it's just. It's like, I think I understand why that is a thing. You know, it can be easy capitalism. It can be from a sense of, oh, these are American mythic figures in a way. And ultimately with these live action remakes, it's like they're chasing after that in a way. Like they would want like some, like I would like the thing is like I would love that. I would love like actual explosion of creativity and adaptation, but they're not doing that.
No,
you know, I think the most varied adaptations we have would be in something like the DC multiverse, across comics, across animated series, across animated films, even among like live action, you know, have a, at least you have a good variety of Batman, you know, like across the board.
I
Yeah.
I will say, like, I do think that adaptations are getting better over time, depending what it is. And I think the One Piece adaptation for me was a really good example of it. So, like, the issues with some of the Netflix live action adaptations, like, I would use Cowboy Bebop as an example. They were very focused on replicating specific scenes, but not focused on making the storytelling good. And also, I think whenever you're adapting something, and I think about this a lot when I review anime that I've also read the manga for, what are you doing to justify your place here? Like, what are you doing differently? How do you capture the heart of the story but do something to make me want to watch this? I know Look Back just came out, which is an adaptation of Fujimoto's One Shot, the guy who did Chainsaw Man. And, like, it is a masterpiece in written work. And when it's adapted, it somehow got even better because of the directorial choices that were made by the animated team, right? And so I think for me, I think of something where it is doing well enough to replicate and be faithful, but also understand the importance of why you're adapting it. And I use One Piece as a good example because what One Piece did was, one, it was made by people who deeply loved One Piece on the acting side and the creator side, but it was also very specifically trying to feel the role that there were over 1,000 episodes of that show. There are over 1,500 chapters of that manga. Getting somebody to come into this and love it in the same way of somebody who has read all of them and not expect them to be scared, that is what that adaptation was doing, even though that show's still running, even though that manga's still being published. So it is one of those things where, like, I think that the place that adaptation should serve should not just be cape stuff. Like, I do actually think it should move beyond that and be like, how do we take this medium that people have kind of ignored or been intimidated by and make it something that is accessible for people to jump into? And I think that that works for animation to live action. I think that that works for I don't think that works. Actually, I don't think there's any reason to remake a foreign movie, if you want me to be honest. But I also think it works on expanding things into video games. I think Dune is actually doing very well with this, with Dune Awakening coming out and Dune Prophecy. And I think that, like, there are different ways to build stories within a universe without directly touching the exact same material. And there are ways to pull in new audiences by making an intimidating piece something worth coming into now.
Y'all know I've had my criticisms of the Dune franchise, but then when I saw part two, I was like, I get it. I understand now. I understand, like, in this adaptation, what this story is trying to say and how it does set up, obviously, for Dune Messiah. And that, you see, the first one for me didn't justify this adaptation, along with my other, like, criticisms of, like, not involving Swanna, you know, the creators in the process. But with the second one, I was like, oh, this is clicking for me, especially because it's actually adapting, like, you know, the climaxes of the book. And I think that's really the spark of it all. Like, what is the reasoning for this adaptation? What is it the creator genuinely wants to say? And have that reason for it. To round this out, not finish the conversation, but to go back to the How to Train Your Dragon piece of it, watching, I know it's just like a few ads of it, but when I watched, like, this conversation with the director, Dean DeBlois, who did the original animation, and he was saying, I wanted to, you know, do a new take or something, whatever. And I'm just like,
didn't do a new take.
You like,
did shot for shot.
And it also wasn't your
take
to remake.
It felt so insincere.
It was a book.
Exactly. It felt so insincere.
I
hate saying that, like, without having interviewed him or whatever, but this is my genuine response to seeing that
marketing
advert.
Materials are there for a reason. If you're gonna market your movie that way, people will respond to it.
I mean, and honestly, to flip it and to go back to Kate talking about you know, there's not really a reason to remake a foreign language film. Willem Dafoe has talked about how much he loves the film Onibaba and has tried to remake it, thought about remaking it. I think at one point had the rights to remake it and then was like, I could never really make it make sense to remake it. So I didn't. And it's like, hell yeah. Like, way to recognize that and to not do it. And yeah, like, it's like him recognizing like, oh, I want to have a take on this. I want to do it. And then being like, well, there's not really a good reason to. There's not really a good way to make this work. I should back out. And I think there's just a lack of self-awareness from a lot of people. And they will plunge into a remake or an adaptation because they want to do it and they want their piece of it. And yeah, I don't know. Does this ever go both ways? Like, has like Japan ever been like, we want to make that American show for us?
Oh, like, yeah. It actually happens all the time in Korea, too. So like Korea,
I'm more interested in watching.
So Korea remade a movie called The Call. It's a horror movie where like a girl comes into like a house and answers the phone and she like calls into the past. And it's like this really crazy thing. But it actually does happen a lot. And like I would say less of like making stuff into animation, but like it does happen a lot where there are retellings. But like, and I do think that like there is probably a wider conversation of around being like, I like this story. This story doesn't fit our cultural context. Let's do it this way. And if you can make something better, okay. I think the problem in the United States is like there is a, and I don't know the process of in Japanese cinema because I'm not a Japanese critic and I'm not a critic living in Japan or a critic living in Korea, which is what The Call was. It was a Korean film. But I think the way we have approached it, to Suara's point about How to Train Your Dragon and every point that we, and even to like the Willem Dafoe piece, is Willem Dafoe was seeing it as being a creative endeavor. He was making art. He wanted to remake art that shaped him and he loved in a way that could, I'm assuming for him, put in reverence, put him into it, be a part of the art that he has loved. And I think what happens a lot, and you can see it with Parasite, because these things are getting greenlit without somebody attached to it. When it is greenlit without somebody attached to it, it's no longer about somebody approaching something to make art. It is about a company greenlighting it to make money. And that is when you lose it. And I think that that is the large issue, especially if you don't involve original creators. And it's weird, which is why I think How to Train Your Dragon baffles me so much, because I'm like, how do you want to do this? Like, why are you here?
It just never, that one didn't make sense to me because the original movie is still insanely enjoyable. Like there was like nothing is going to be added, honestly. Also, I do want to, while we're talking about the idea of like creatives and is it for money or for whatever. Do you guys know about the fish scene in Snowpiercer?
Yes.
So there's a very weird scene in Snowpiercer where they open the next train car and there's a bunch of dudes holding fish and then it turns into a fight scene. And apparently the studio tried to cut it and Bong Joon-ho just lied through his teeth about it being like culturally or personally significant to him and like something about his dad and all this stuff so that they would stop questioning the scene and just let it be in the movie. Which, yes. I mean, that kind of goes to the studio involvement of it and, like, the capitalism of it all. Of like, if you have to lie to get a scene kept in the film, then the movie isn't being approached honestly by the studio. Because they're more concerned with, you know, and also that seems like something where it's like, let a test audience sort out if that scene should be there. If you show this movie to 500 people and all of them are like, what the hell was the fish scene? Then it's like, okay, I guess maybe it gets cut. But if no one cares, then you were wrong to be against it to begin with.
I think we've brought it up on this podcast before, but like making things by committee is ultimately what is Hollywood's death knell right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like by and large, these studio executives don't actually know what audiences want.
Yeah.
And audiences, especially, you know, parents with kids, will take them out to whatever's out there. I was having like a conversation with my fiance the other day about like our own future kids, inshallah, like of whether I will withhold, you know, as a dad, knowing that so many of these live actions suck, but will I withhold taking them to them? You know, that's the difficult thing. You know, because parents do need like something to distract their kids with, although I would argue you should show them older, better material. But even then the kids will be like, oh, but my friend saw it and I can't discuss it or something like that. So there is that communal aspect, and maybe like more parents should like be demanding better. Not that they do in their daily lives because they're so busy with so much else. But it is like, it's a means of entertainment. It's a means of, you know, even though, for example, right now, Moana 2 is getting like really mediocre reviews. It's still probably going to make a lot of money because like
parents are still going to take their kids. Yeah. Which also, speaking of live action adaptations, Moana getting a movie that came out less than a decade ago. Yeah.
Dwayne Johnson does not look good as live action Maui.
I saw like a behind the scenes photo and it was weird. But yeah, do you guys, do you have any closing thoughts or should we wrap this up? I feel like that was a very long, productive conversation.
No, I think we can wrap it up. I mean, my closing thought is just that like everybody who's listening to this, go watch Flea, go watch Intergalactic, go watch Memoir of a Snail, do things that you don't see promoted. It doesn't mean they're going to be good. Yeah. But I think that like we have to make a concerted effort to showcase that when we do get media that we say we yearn for, we follow up with it and we tweet about it. We write, we suggest it to friends. And that goes down to international film as well. We are in the most accessible age for getting international films. I no longer have to find a French movie where at the end people get casted into concrete after they found each other in the bottom of like a quick $3 rental bin at Blockbuster. I can just go on to Prime Video and get it. Some of the, like, that's how you expand your horizons for action films. That's how you expand your horizons for dramas. That's how you learn about other people. And honestly, learn that you can connect with other people. I think if right now the people in the US watched more Korean films based on class, we would see ourselves reflected in a way that we're actually not seeing ourselves shown in American media. And I think that once you step out of the comfort zone, to steal Bong Joon-ho's piece, get over the 1-inch barrier of subtitles, we can do a lot. And we can prop up the people that we want. So,
definitely. Swara, anything to add to that? I personally feel like that was encompassing for me.
Yeah, it, totally for me as well. 1,000% echo everything Kate said. To add on to it, however, I think expanding on the getting out of our comfort zones piece, that really is the franchises. You know, you can still love the franchises, but they are not the end all be all. To be honest, like that's a lesson I've had to learn, and I think I still am learning. I still, I still am deprogramming myself out of it. And you just experience like the films Kate mentioned. You experience those, experience more art that's just richer culturally, diversity in its thought and its approach, and that will enrich your own work if you are a creator yourself or your own writing, if you're writing about this, or just share it amongst your friends and don't think that, oh, this is artsy fartsy and, you know, not really your jam. You just want to watch the franchise thing anyway. Just expose yourself and you'll find yourself in, and your friends if you take them, and your family and your kids. Take your kids to see them, expose them to international and the quote unquote artsy fartsy films. More independent work, and you'll see the dividends.
Yeah.
So,
and like, as an audience member, approach film with humility and curiosity, and you will watch things significantly more interesting than live action American movies. That's kind of it. But yeah, I think that does it for this week. If you at home want more, we've got it for you. We are on Blue Sky, and you can subscribe to the newsletter, donate to the site. Sorry, let me restart that. That does it for this week, I think. But if you guys want more at home, we've got it. But Why Though is on Blue Sky. You can also go to butwhythough.net/support and you can sign up for our newsletter or donate to the site. Everything donated keeps the site going, helps us to make the content that you enjoy. Kate, Swara, thank you guys so much for joining me, and thank you at home for listening. We'll see you next week.